I'm about to speak with a Christian professor who says that the church in many ways is misunderstanding atheists.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
We are going to have a very interesting conversation today with Professor Randall Rauser. We'll be discussing his new book, Is the Atheist My Neighbor? We'll be doing that in a few minutes. This is Michael Brown. Welcome to The Line of Fire, 866-34-TRUTH. It's 866-348-7884. If you're listening and you're a former atheist and you want to weigh in, if you're listening and you currently would identify as an atheist or agnostic and want to bring your perspective, I'm sure Professor Rauser would love to hear from you, would be happy to interact with you, whether it's an agreement or disagreement. We'll be getting to that in a few minutes. A lot of my friends following the stock market carefully these days, wondering, is there going to be some kind of collapse in September? The whole mystery of the Shemitah that Jonathan Cahn has written about in these seven-year cycles that tie in with the biblical calendar. Of course, Jonathan has said that nothing has to happen. It's not like there's some guarantee something's going to happen. God's not obligated to do something, even based on his interpretation and theology here. Jonathan and I spent some time together in Pennsylvania last week. Just a few days ago, we spent some time together, and while there, we compared notes, and we do feel the same way, that there really is a serious judgment coming to America, that we're in the midst of it in many ways already, and that we expect revival. We expect God to move in the midst of it. As you know, I'm anything but a financial expert. I'm anything but a stock market expert. That's why you don't hear me talk much about these things. There are 1,000 other people on the radio that have more to say with knowledge and background about these issues than I do. I'm simply saying that I find it interesting. The big reports on Drudge, turbulence hit streets, the upheaval in Greece, the euro and all of that. What does it mean? We'll see. But for sure, there's a lot of world upheaval and world uncertainty right now. My latest article I wrote last night, I wasn't expecting to write this, but I got a request from Christian Post, and they said, listen, Matthew Vines, this gay activist, has put out 40 questions. Kevin DeYoung, Christian author, put out 40 questions for Matthew Vines and others that advocate, quote, gay Christianity, mean practicing homosexuality and following Jesus at the same time. And Matthew, in response, well, I've really answered those in my book, so here are 40 questions of mine. Well, I could have said I've answered a lot of them in my book, Can You Be Gay and Christian? But at the request of Christian Post, I spent some time last night and wrote out my answers to these 40 questions and added in two closing questions for Matthew Vines and his allies. The article is getting a lot of attention already. Christian Post contacted me earlier today and said, wow, getting a lot of hits. I think you'll find it instructive, helpful, eye-opening. So go to my website, askdrbrown.org. Just click on latest article. And I did a little talk on video yesterday. We video record certain parts of the show. At some point, we'll probably video record and even live stream large portions or even all of the broadcast. But right now, we're just recording select segments. So I did a little talk. We don't want to call it a rant. It's not what Dave Ramsey calls this thing, a rant. We don't want to call it a rant because a rant could have negative connotations, but it's kind of like a spiritual rant. We're trying to find the right word for it. So if you've got the right word for us, you let us know, and we'll come up with it. We'll use that. But it's a short video, 6 minutes, where I kind of unload on the absurdity of the ruling in Oregon, the ruling against the Christian couple, Aaron and Melissa Klein, the absurdity of it on video. So you can watch that as well on our YouTube channel. We'll be right back with Professor Randall Rauser, and we'll talk about, is the atheist my neighbor?
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Religion has actually convinced people that there's an invisible man living in the sky who watches everything you do every minute of every day. And the invisible man has a special list of 10 things he does not want you to do. And if you do any of these 10 things, he has a special place full of fire and smoke and burning and torture and anguish where he will send you to live and suffer and burn and choke and scream and cry forever and ever till the end of time. But he loves you.
That was the voice of George Carlin, expressing what many of us as believers might think is the spirit of atheism, hostile, mocking, antagonistic, arrogant. And we might respond to atheists as if they hate God. Randall Rouser, professor of historical theology at Taylor Seminary in Edmonton, author of many books with some great titles, including The Swedish Atheist, The Scuba Diver, and Other Apologetic Rabbit Trails. He blogs and podcasts as the Tentative Apologist at RandallRouser.com. He's got a new book, Is the Atheist My Neighbor? Rethinking Christian Attitudes Toward Atheism. Randall, great to have you on the broadcast today.
Thanks for having me, Dr. Brown.
Glad to do it. Randall, when you went to write this book, were you writing it to correct what you perceive to be wrong attitudes towards atheists in the church today?
Yeah, that was pretty much my starting point. I think beginning with that George Carlin clip is a great way to begin, because that is the perception a lot of Christians have, and there is some truth to it, which is why those attitudes persist. But I found it just a lot more complicated than that.
Right. So are we wrong to say, in general, that atheists, those who identify as atheists, not even agnostics, but who say we're atheists, we don't believe that God exists, are we wrong to generalize and to say, well, there's arrogance, there's antagonism? Because to be honest, a lot of atheists I hear from through social media, they're not just saying, hey, I don't believe what you believe. They seem very, very hostile. Where do you think our attitudes might be misguided there?
Well, I guess it depends what we mean by generalize. I think what we can do is expect that many atheists do have some degree of hostility toward Christians, just like many Christians have some degree of hostility toward atheists. The danger is that when we bring those assumptions to our interaction with atheists. So to give an example, a few years ago I met Nate Phelps. Now, he's the son of Fred Phelps, who is the now deceased pastor of the infamous Westboro Baptist Church that everybody hears about, the one that pickets funerals and so on. And what I found is, Nate Phelps, people like him, they have a certain perception of Christianity based upon some pretty bad exemplars. And I think likewise, Christians can have perceptions of atheists based upon some pretty bad exemplars, maybe including the George Carlin clip. So what we simply have to do is maybe try to set aside some of those assumptions and just meet people from where they are and try to hear what their views are and why they hold those views.
Now, how do you come to have a personal interest in this, Randall?
I don't know. In one sense, maybe it's just the way I'm wired. I've just found myself time and again coming into conversation with atheists, trying to understand what their perspective is. I think one of the issues for me as a Christian apologist is, you know, atheists still are a relatively small segment of the North American population, maybe 7 or 8%, but there's maybe 20, 30% of the population that on census forms would say that they are described as nuns or they have no religious affiliation. Mm-hmm. And that is a very quickly growing group. If you go over the seas to Europe, perhaps between one-third and one-half of the population in many European countries is actually atheistic. It was, when I lived in London for 2 years, London, England, it was about one-third of the population. So it seems to me that we can't afford to ignore this demographic, and we do need to be in conversation with them.
All right, so you meet your average atheist. Well, there's no such thing as an average atheist any more than an average Christian. You meet your atheist neighbor. Should you make any assumptions or to the contrary, come in there making no assumptions because you really have no idea the grid, the background of this person, and why that they say that they're an atheist. What would your counsel be? You got an atheist neighbor, you start chatting, they find out you're a believer, they say, I'm an atheist. What's next?
Yeah, I guess what is next is to ask them. I mean, we could have probably certain presuppositions about what they're likely to be like, but you just won't know until you ask them. I mean, if there is such an enormous diversity, as you just alluded to, in the Christian community as to what it means to be a Christian. And so ultimately, you really have to just talk to a person to find out what they mean when they say they're a Christian. Likewise, when it comes to atheists. I mean, one of the interesting things in the last few years that we're seeing is some people will even define themselves as an atheist, but they'll say, it's not that I believe there is no God, it's that I'm without belief in God. Now, that is actually historically defined as agnosticism, or mm-hmm. you're not having a belief as to whether God exists or not. So you really do need to get into a conversation to find out what a person means when they say that they're an atheist.
All right. Certainly there are those who say that the idea of a God is ridiculous and scientifically false. In fact, let's grab clip number four, Dennis. This is a gentleman named Ed Falzon. It's on a show called The Point with Anna Kasparian, and he's talking about atheists and their view of religion, science, and morality. Clip number four, listen to what he has to say in terms of proving the non-existence of God.
There is abundant evidence on the non-existence of the Judeo-Christian God.
Yeah.
And this is something that can be disproven and has been disproven archaeologically and historically. You know, we spent the last 150 years, ever since there was the first real critical exegesis of the Bible in the mid-19th century in Germany. Anyone with a spade went into Israel and Syria and Egypt and started digging up, trying to find proof. And of course, what they found was not only no evidence in favor of the Bible, but everything they found contradicted the biblical account.
All right. Now, Old Testament scholarship being my area of focus, much of what he said is quite absurd. But how many atheists do you think, Randall, what percentage, you know, we're just talking broadly here, actually believe that you can scientifically demonstrate the non-existence of God?
Well, let me tweak that a little bit. And I'll put it this way, that I would say what percentage of atheists think that theism or Christianity is just irrational or absurd? And frankly, I think that there are a lot of them. Mm-hmm. There was a book by a couple sociologists, Yancey, and I forget the other fellow's last name. I think it's called There Is No God, Atheism in America. And they did a study of surveying atheist opinions about religion, theism, and Christianity. And they found that it is very common and widespread for atheists to have an opinion that Christianity is just absurd and ridiculous, and they're very dismissive of it. So they would have, I think, an attitude similar to this quote you just had, this clip. But I think it's just also important to recognize those kinds of attitudes are also widespread in the Christian community with regard to atheism, that it is common to assume that atheism is just an intellectually absurd, ridiculous position. And I think the challenge on both sides is for us to try to bring more nuance to our belief community and to help people within our community come to the recognition that, you know, maybe there is at least something to be said for this other position. It's not absurd. I mean, I'm certainly not an atheist, but I can understand why people take an atheistic position when you look at things like the problem of evil.
Right. So even if you put scientific issues away, just the problem of suffering raises all kinds of issues, which means that you may have one person who is blustery and angry and speaking out against the deity and maligning him in the strongest of terms because he's angry and arrogant and hates God. And you have another person speaking out the same way because they prayed and prayed and prayed for their 2-year-old to be healed of cancer and the child died. And there's disappointment and hurt. So often what you see on the outside doesn't really reflect what's going on the inside. Is that true?
Yeah, I think that's right. And in fact, and even when you meet people that are really angry, I think the question is, are they really angry at God, or maybe they're angry at the church, somebody in the church that has hurt them in the past. Sort of the first question I always want to ask, if I encounter an atheist who is very demeaning, very condescending, very dismissive of my beliefs and my commitments, I want to ask that question just in the back of my mind. Well, what motivates that degree of antagonism? Is it really that they just hate God, or was it perhaps that they were really hurt by a Christian in the past, and I'm now becoming the target of that past experience?
Exactly. So we come back. I want to talk about that. I want to raise the question of, say, emotional atheism versus intellectual atheism. The new book by Randall Rouser is The Atheist, My Neighbor, Rethinking Christian Attitudes Towards Atheism. It's very much user-friendly, just about 100 pages long, easy to read, and practical.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I'm speaking with Professor Randall Rouser. His new book is The Atheist, My Neighbor, Rethinking Christian Attitudes Towards Atheism. I've gotten to know Randall a little bit in the last year or so, and he is one to tackle controversial positions as I am, and often to come from a little bit of a different angle that challenges some sacred Christian ideas. So it's good to have discussion in that way and to get us to think outside of the box a little bit. Randall, I've been confronted with the new atheism like everybody has, and you've got the people like Dawkins, who's a great scientist, and the late Christopher Hitchens, a great intellectual. And yet, if you read a book, a well-known book by Dr. Paul Vitz, himself a former atheist, and there are other studies like this, The Faith of the Fatherless, Dr. Vitz argued that in many cases, atheism goes back to the loss of a father in early childhood, or broken relationship with a weak or distant father, or some deep, deep spiritual or natural disappointment where it looked like God didn't come through. So that initially, it's something emotional, which then, over a period of time, may develop into a fully blown intellectual atheism as well. When I debated Professor Bart Ehrman, who's a famous agnostic and New Testament scholar, we debated, does the Bible provide an adequate answer to the problem of suffering? And people were wondering, their perception, their question, why is he angry? Who does he seem angry with? And from what I could tell, just based on what he said in the debate and reading his book, it seemed that there was great disappointment that his father wasn't healed of cancer, and that was part of what led to a breakdown of the faith and almost an anger. How common is that kind of thing, that there's something of a disappointment, a failure in the church, something that underlies what may seem like an intellectual atheism today?
I think that as a general observation, human beings are driven by, or at least deeply guided by, their emotions and experiences, and often we're not even aware of the extent to which those do guide us. And I think that is a very common kind of scenario that you describe. I talk about briefly about one example in the book of an atheist who recalls her own experience back when she was 6 or 7 years old in elementary school. And her teacher at that time, now she was growing up with atheist parents, and already at that age of 6 or 7, she knew what atheism was. This teacher in the classroom said that people who are atheists get leprosy. And she always remembered that. And now, as she writes this essay in a philosophy book defending atheism, she recalls that experience and expresses this deep anger at that woman. So you can't help but wonder, to what degree was that experience formative for her, setting her on a life course in atheism? Now, I do think it goes the other way as well. There could be emotional factors that draw people to God or Christianity. So I don't think that the emotional dimension is necessarily exclusive of the rational dimension. I think it's just important to recognize that it is always a factor there. And we always do need to try to understand, what are the emotional dimensions and the background experiences that might drive a person to adopt a particular view?
Right. And I think it is important to recognize emotional, rational, the cross-section there, and both for believer an unbeliever. No argument with it. Again, sometimes we look at it as if it's purely intellectual when there can be something behind it. And we have to be reminded as believers that sometimes the lashing out is anger and rebellion, and sometimes the lashing out is hurt and disappointment. It's almost like people in a relationship and one person breaks up and the other one says, I hate you. Well, the minute before they loved you, but now reject it, they hate you. And we've often heard, say, a summary of the new atheist position is there is no God and I hate him. Do you feel that's fair or unfair?
I do think that you get certainly some of that kind of rage, because new atheism, one of its distinctive traits or characteristics is what we often call this stream of anti-theism. So Christopher Hitchens, one of the new atheists, passed away 4 years ago. He was known for defining himself not merely as an atheist, but as an anti-theist. So he was actually, right, he would say he was against God. Now, one of the interesting things is when you listen to what Christopher Hitchens describes God as, he would talk about God as being a despot like Kim Jong-un, the ruler of North Korea, somebody who monitors every one of your actions and has sort of nefarious intentions to control you in your life. So one of the challenges I'm left with is, well, is Christopher Hitchens really rejecting God when he talks like that, or is he rejecting this caricature of belief? So there is that dimension that complicates things a bit when you have people expressing this hostility toward God, but then you say, well, what kind of God is it you believe in? And they have this monstrosity described. I'm sort of left wondering, are they even talking about the same being that I believe in?
Right. I was looking at a post that someone put up on my Facebook page the other day. This guy is just another cultist who worships the evil, mass-murdering, incest-obsessed, rape-encouraging, and hate-mongering God of Abraham as a good thing. Anyone who worships evil is good and claims that basic human rights is something to be fought against is a threat to civilization and a terrorist. So on the one hand, you could say, yeah, he's got a complete misconception of God. That's why he rejects him. On the other hand, I could make a biblical case that that is simply sinful human nature and human beings in rebellion against God. So it's not a misconception. It's overt rebellion. How do we distinguish between the two?
Well, I guess that one of the things I just want to come back to and is, I mean, my point in writing this book is not to say certainly that no atheists are in rebellion against God, but simply to say that you simply need to get to know people and get into conversation with them. Just like
you find
the Fred Phelps out there, but you also find Christians who are deeply compassionate and loving and really embody the spirit of Christ. And I think with atheists as well, some people like this fellow you talk about, I mean, I wouldn't even try to have a conversation with him. He's not in a place to be able to listen charitably and interact, I suspect. But there are other atheists who are not like that. And I do find that a soft answer tends to turn away wrath. So if you begin with a sort of open hand, you're more likely to have a helpful conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. So, friends, the book is The Atheist, My Neighbor: Rethinking Christian Attitudes Towards Atheism by Randall Rouser. It'll help you to approach an atheist in a more constructive way. It'll give you insight as to why some atheists may think the way they do, or perhaps things that we do in order to buttress our viewpoint that actually are detrimental to our witness to atheists. Listen, I'm going to continue this conversation with Randall into the next half hour. If you need to listen online, go to AskDrBrown.org. Just click on the Listen Live banner. We'll interact with an atheist, in fact, when we come back. And friends, I want to encourage you. We are so blessed by the flood of comments that you send our way, thanking us for the broadcast, thanking us for the writings that we put out, thanking us for the videos that we put out. I just want to encourage you to be praying for us, and if the Lord lays it on your heart, to stand with us, to partner together with us on the front lines. Together, you and I are making a difference, but everything we do, this radio broadcast and everything we do, it is listener-sponsored. It's sponsored by friends of this ministry. Why don't you partner with us? If we've been a blessing to you, why don't you stand with us? Go to the website, AskDrBrown.org, to get involved.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks for joining us on the Line of Fire. Our subject this hour is The Atheist, My Neighbor, a new book by Randall Rouser, Rethinking Christian Attitudes Towards Atheism. Yeah, there are things sometimes we'll post on our Facebook page that will be controversial, basically challenging the viewpoint of an atheist or challenging the idea that everything was created by nothing or that human DNA just happened to occur. We'll post those things, obviously, to provoke discussion and to say we reject this mindset. Is that the most practical way to reach out to an atheist? How do we understand where atheists are coming from? That's why Randall wrote this book. So, Randall, let's take some calls, and then I've got a bunch more questions for you as well. Let's go to Washington, D.C. James, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
So, to be fair, I've only heard the last few minutes of the last segment, so this may have been addressed, so if I'm being repetitive, I apologize, but I just wanted to make it clear that from my point of view and from a lot of atheists that I know, it's not necessary. Some of us are atheists simply because we're not convinced of the arguments of a given religion, not because of a emotional reaction or a feeling of rejection or anything like that. It's just an idea of here's a thought process or an ideology that I am not convinced is true, mm-hmm. and therefore I don't have a belief in it.
Got it.
I just want to make it clear that that's how some of us, even possibly a majority of us, get to this position.
Got it. And Randall, that's something that you spell out quite explicitly in your book, correct?
Yeah. So I think there are, like I said earlier, there are some atheists who have deep emotional factors that contribute to their disbelief, just like there are some Christians who have deep emotional factors that contribute to their belief. But my point in the book is to argue what James is saying, that there are atheists out there who have considered the evidence as best they can, and it's not that they have a chip on their shoulder, it's just that they're not compelled to accept this set of beliefs. I have a chapter there where I interact with a well-known atheist named Jeff Lauder, and let him lay out his case for atheism and metaphysical naturalism. And what I think if people read that is they find, Jeff is somebody who's very courteous in interaction. I don't find any chip on his shoulder, and he's also very articulate and rational, and he provides evidence for his belief system. It doesn't compel me, but then my views don't compel him, and that's the start of a good conversation.
So, James, as you identify as an atheist, I imagine you have atheist friends. How many would you say are in that same boat, that you've examined it and you just have not found compelling evidence to believe in a God?
I would say the majority. I think the one thing where I'm sort of an anomaly is that I wasn't raised with any religious culture, so I didn't have anything to leave, so to speak, where the majority of my friends have. And I can say that the ones that experience any sort of emotional, even anger, most of it is toward their family members who oftentimes shun them. And so therefore they've got some grief around the concept of religion and the people who are, the religious people in their life. But that doesn't, most of them, I should say, the ones that I know, leave religion because they no longer find it convincing, but their emotional reaction they have is really towards their family members and friends that then sort of leave them behind.
Got it. All right. So it's more of a complex issue, but then ultimately religion and then the one behind religion, God, becomes the target of the hostility. Hey, James, I appreciate you calling. Keep listening. I trust that the conversation will be helpful, and I pray that God will make himself real in your life and that you'll have the humility of heart to receive him when that happens. But thank you for listening. My guest, Professor Randall Rouser. The book is The Atheist, My Neighbor. We'll be right back with more of your calls. I'll get Randall to interact directly with some atheist clips as well.
Give us strength to always do what's right. It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
God that our neighbors believe in is essentially an invisible person. It's a creator deity who created the universe to have a relationship with one species of primate. Lucky us. And he's got galaxy upon galaxy to attend to, but he's especially concerned with what we do, and he's especially concerned with what we do while naked.
All right, that was the voice of well-known atheist Sam Harris. My guest, Randall Rouser, the author of many books. His newest is The Atheist, My Neighbor, Rethinking Christian Attitudes Towards Atheism. Randall's not denying that there is rebellion in the hearts against God of many human beings and hatred towards God, but that if we look at atheists in just kind of a monolithic way, well, they all just hate God, and that's why they feel this way, as opposed to recognize there could be many reasons for their atheism, then we won't effectively reach out to them. Randall, let me pose something to you, not in a debating way. I'm sure you're happy to debate, but I didn't ask you on the air to debate today. Maybe we debate something another day and have some fun at it.
Sure.
But just to take the other side for a moment, because the new atheism is so popular, and because it's got these famous little sound bites and clips and, you know, the hostile deity type picture and all of this, it does empower or fuel the fire of atheists to be even more antagonistic. You know, a quote like that from Sam Harris. So even if the guy next door is just one of these, hey, grew up really without a lot of beliefs, studied a lot of things, and has not concluded that God exists or is pretty sure God doesn't exist. But you've got this general undercurrent out there of a hostile, aggressive, angry atheism. They intersect a lot. How do we separate one from the other in the culture in which we live?
Well, so one of the things I did in my book was I spent a chapter looking at historic Christian attitudes toward atheism. And what I discovered was that there is, going back three centuries, which is really as far back as you'll find atheism as a modern phenomenon, that throughout that time, mainstream Christian leaders in the church have said some pretty shocking things about atheists. To give one example, Charles Spurgeon in the 19th century, he describes atheists as worse than the devils of hell, and he quotes favorably Joseph Addison, who was a hymn writer and an essayist, and Addison refers to atheists as a vermin, so like a pestilence that you've got to eradicate. And so if I want to understand the recent hostility that one finds in new atheism over the last 10 to 15 years, it's worthwhile considering the extent to which Christians have exhibited a deep hostility and dismissiveness and condescension toward atheists going back 300 years. And, I mean, I just find time and again, that really just reframes the conversation. So I begin to have a little bit more sympathy with these people. Now, I mean, Sam Harris, I mean, that's, you know, an unfortunate clip, you know, that you play there. But at the same time, one thing you find from listening to atheists is they do challenge Christians to consider beliefs and from another perspective. And one common example of that is atheists will spend a lot of time, in my experience, familiarizing themselves with things like the problem of biblical violence, you know, the fact that God often seems to act in a very violent way. And those are passages in the Bible that Christians often would rather avoid. Well, interacting with an atheist is going to force you to begin to confront and think about some of those difficult issues. So I think there's a lot of value in having those kinds of conversations.
Yeah, it's interesting. I had Sean McDowell on yesterday, son of Josh McDowell, and we were talking about a book that he co-authored with John Stone Street about the same-sex, quote, marriage issue. And he was talking about an apologetic settings where sometimes he'll role-play and he'll be the atheist or the hostile non-believer. So everyone knows he's role-playing, but within a short period of time, he's got Christians losing their temper and yelling at him and everything. So many times we're insecure in what we believe, and when someone challenges it, it comes to the surface, or we're not equipped to answer. And when we get exposed, on the one hand, we're jealous for the Lord, and it grieves us when people attack him, but he's not insecure in that respect, and we ought not to be either. Let me grab another call, and then we'll get back to some questions I have. We go to Bloomington, Illinois. Leon, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Yes. Hello, Dr. Brown and Adam. I stumbled across your website, and I'm really intrigued by this. I kind of have a question twofold that might have the possibility of killing two birds with one stone. So just bear with me. I guess what I'm referring to is atheism and evolution. And would it be appropriate to put both of them together in that mostly or all atheists are evolutionists?
Go ahead, Randall.
Yeah, well, I do think that most atheists are evolutionists. They would accept the neo-Darwinian theory of evolution. One important thing to recognize is that many Christians accept some form of theistic evolution, and this isn't a recent change. I mean, back in the 1860s, evolution's main supporter in North America was an evangelical scientist named Asa Gray. B.B. Warfield, the early 20th century, late 19th century Reformed theologian, he didn't have a problem with evolution. James Orr also was a theistic evolutionist, and he was one of the contributors to the Fundamentals, which was the set of books that were the basis for the fundamentalist movement. And even today, you have people like Francis Collins, who's an evangelical Christian, was the head of the Human Genome Project, and is also a theistic evolutionist and the founder or co-founder of the BioLogos organization. So I don't see that there's a... I'll say this, that there's room for Christians to disagree on the way that God created, but it's no surprise that among atheists, evolution is the predominant view.
Yeah. All right, go ahead, Leon.
Yeah, I'm just thinking also, like, it seems to me in this day and time with Christian theologists and et cetera, and I support the sound doctrine, it seems like maybe there is a slight leaning toward believing evolution. And I just kind of wondered, a warning going out, or how does that how do you feel about that?
You go first, Randall, then I'll go.
Okay, sure. Well, for me, I mean, I don't have any problem with theistic evolution. One of the issues that it comes back to is the question of the kind of literature that one finds in Genesis 1 and 2. And there's a lot of different views out there as to what that is. John Walton is one well-known Old Testament scholar who's taken a particular view on Genesis 1 that's consistent with theistic evolution. So in my view, that's more of a scientific question. I don't think that the biblical texts determine how one ought to think about that. That would also require you to think, well, then what is Paul doing, for example, in Romans 5, when he's tying the new Adam to the first Adam in terms of fall and then redemption? And so those are all complex questions to be having. But I think that there's room for Christians to take that view.
Got it. Hey, thank you, Leon, for getting us on this train of thought. I appreciate it. Yeah, so just to weigh in real quickly on this, and then I want to come back to evolution and the question of the rejection of God through it. John Walton's a terrific Old Testament, ancient, and Eastern scholar. I'm not convinced about his Genesis 1 as a temple model paradigm there. I do believe, though, that Genesis 1 is there primarily to teach us about who God is and how he operates, as opposed to primarily to give us scientific information. I felt that way for many years, which is why I've had on my show both old earth creationists and young earth creationists. The old earth creationists seem perfectly happy with the fact that I have young earth creationists on the air and we can discuss these issues. The young earth creationists don't seem as happy that I've had old earth creationists on. For me, though, if there is, quote, evolution, it's more just change within species as opposed to from one species to another. And I would believe the Bible does address that, and the need for there to be a historical Adam, as you mentioned, Romans 5, and the passages to me is very, very important. But Randall, I have kind of a black hole when it came to scientific learning. In high school, when the science classes got serious, I was getting high and not paying attention. Then we went on strike and started a new school within our school, and we had no formal classes. And then I got saved in the midst of that and was just reading the Word day and night. Then when I went to college, I never took science classes. So I was never negatively influenced by the teaching of evolution. But I've been amazed to ask how many people at one point in their lives lost their faith, either high school or college, through the teaching of evolution. So it is really a major issue right to this day in our education system.
It is, but the question is, so what is the ultimate catalyst of that? I mean, one way to interpret it is to say the problem there is that evolution is being opposed to Christianity. So it's you're forced to choose between evolution and Christianity. That would certainly be Francis Collins' view as a representative of Biologos. And that would be my sympathies as well, that I would never want a person to think that they're compelled to leave Christianity because they take a particular view on the way that God created the diversity of species. Just like in the 17th century, I would never want somebody to leave Christianity because they became convinced that the sun is the center of the universe rather than the earth.
Got it. So again, that's another discussion in terms of how we should read Scripture in terms of what it's intended to teach or not. All right, stay with me. I've just got a couple more questions for you. The book is The Atheist My Neighbor, Randall Rouser, Rethinking Christian Attitudes Towards Atheism.
The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
We're here! We're godless! Get used to it!
All right, that was the Atheist Rally for Reason on the National Mall. My guest, Randall Rouser, his book is The Atheist My Neighbor. All right, Randall, want to reiterate, you're not denying that human beings can be in rebellion against God and hence hate God, that there are many who are hostile to the thought of a God because they don't want there to be a God. They want to do their own thing. There is that arrogance that we heard in that clip from the rally, so-called Rally for Reason on the National Mall. And yet you're saying, hey, look, there are two sides to this. Sometimes the church has treated atheists in a certain way that exacerbates the reaction. And the best thing is to do our best to treat the atheist as a neighbor and reach out, have a conversation. What do you think Christians stand to learn by having conversations with a friendly atheist?
Well, one example I mentioned earlier was an articulate atheist conversation partner will point out things such as, problematic dimensions of the Bible in terms of what do we do with biblical violence. They might be able to point out, for example, some of the scientific evidence for certain things like evolution, although I already said I don't think that's incompatible with Christianity, but for some people it is. They would certainly point out aspects of the problem of evil, and including natural evil, so the evil that one finds in the natural world. Charles Darwin himself really agonized, as an example, over a particular wasp named Ichneumonidae, which lays its eggs in a caterpillar, and then the eggs hatch, and they slowly eat their way out of the caterpillar while it sort of writhes around. And he was asking this question, why would a good creator God create something like Ichneumonidae to lay its eggs in this caterpillar? And there's so much suffering in the natural world, and it does raise an interesting question for Christians. So those are exactly the kinds of issues that an atheist is likely to press on the Christian, and they're issues that we should not be afraid to confront, because we should never be afraid to confront truth and the complexity of belief.
All right, so you're going to help us with one more thing. How do you answer that when they come to you and ask you about that particular horrific part of God's creation, and why would a good God create something so evil and malicious? What do you say?
Well, so that brings us into the area that we call theodicy, which comes from a couple words in Greek to justify God's ways to human beings. And Christians have long engaged in this practice of theodicy, of trying to explain things like the problem of evil. I think part of the answer is to say that God has morally sufficient reasons for allowing evil in the world. And I think part of that is the character formation of his creatures. One of the reasons there is evil and suffering is to challenge his creatures to develop virtues and come into relationship with him. And I think ultimately, so one illustration that's been given is we are looking at the backside of history like, the backside of a mosaic that's brought together with all these threads, and on the back you
yep.
can see all the knots and the stray ends. You turn it around, which is the space of eternity, and you will see how it all works together. And so we can have that trust knowing that God allows evil for his greater purposes.
So bottom line for you, Randall, you're aware of the objections, you're aware of the issues, the problems, yet you're a committed Christian believer. For you, what is the the bottom line basis of your own faith in God?
Well, the question is a little bit ambiguous, perhaps. I think the bottom line basis for me is that I believe I've experienced Jesus Christ in my life and I have a relationship with him, and I want to share that with others. But I also recognize the ambiguities of existence and that other people can have reasonable positions and they can be people of good character and yet disagree with me. And that recognition is the starting point for me to share my beliefs with them and for them to share their beliefs with me without either one of us feeling under threat or that we have to marginalize the other person.
Right. So in that sense, then, would you agree that apologetics is not just for, obviously, within the church, the building up of our faith and our understanding and our ability to respond, but for the world, is not so much evangelism, but often pre-evangelism, because ultimately there has to be some encounter with God for someone to truly embrace him beyond just an intellectual acknowledgement.
Yeah, I don't think anybody gets argued into the kingdom of God, but I do think the Holy Spirit uses arguments in order to remove obstacles and objections, and sometimes I think the Spirit uses arguments as the occasion by which he draws people into faith. So I do think it's a minority of people. Most people aren't drawn by arguments, but they are a valuable tool. So I do like to think of apologetics sort of as like an evangelism of the mind. And yeah. And it's just one more tool that we have in interacting with other people.
Yeah, and it's necessary. It's valuable. I engage in it day and night. I was forced to as a new believer, a Jewish believer in Jesus, meeting with rabbis as soon as I was come to faith. So you're kind of thrown into the ocean and have to learn to swim. But we've got to learn. We've got to understand how to confront things. We've got to understand how to answer things gently. Even just our approach, even knowing that there may be more going on in this person's heart and mind than is apparent from the outside is important. So the new book, Randall Rouser is the Atheist, My Neighbor, Rethinking Christian Attitudes Towards Atheism. He blogs and podcasts as the Tentative Apologist at randallrouser.com. He's got a three-part review of my book, Can You Be Gay and Christian, which I mentioned on the air to remind me that I have promised I will finish writing my response. It's positive, but it's critical, so it's really helpful in that respect. So look forward to interacting further, and maybe one day we can pick a subject and have a friendly debate on it on the air. But thanks for writing the book, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Dr. Brown. It's been a pleasure.
You bet. All right. So lot to think about. Again, the book is The Atheist, My Neighbor. And thank you if you're listening as an atheist or as an agnostic or someone just really not sure where you stand, what you believe. Thank you for listening in and being part of the broadcast. I just noticed this post on Facebook a moment ago. Hans, I've been trying to get your message out, but everyone who sees it, who has even the most limited grasp on reason and reality, insists you're a nut job. Is this a common reaction? And I wrote back when I had the opportunity, what do you know? On the one hand, we receive overwhelming support to our message, far more than we receive hostility. That being said, there is a ton of hostility towards the truth and light today, as if everyone just drank the Kool-Aid. So yes, it's a really dark, confused day. Sometimes the best response is to ask polite questions, asking them why they feel the way they do and trying to draw them out. Beyond them, keep getting the word out and pray. Here's how you can help us, all right? You can help us in a tangible way. Maybe my calling is to be like the tip of the spear or the tip of the arrow, and your calling is to be part of that hand that pulls the bow back or the bow itself. Then you help shoot this message out further so it goes further and reaches more people. You can do it by praying for us. You can do it by telling other people to tune into the broadcast. You can do it by sharing my messages, the things that we write and post. Do it by Facebook or Twitter. You can do it by being a monthly supporter, a torchbearer. If you can help us with a dollar or more per day, we'll send you first a thank you book that will equip you, light a fire in your heart. Every month, we'll send you a new audio message. You get a 15% discount in our online bookstore and access to our free online classes, only free for you. Go to AskDrBrown.org to join us. My bottom line today, God himself intervening is the ultimate answer to atheism. Well, the hot button issues, the controversies, we'll tackle them right here. We'll give you sound wisdom from the living word of God.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right, we are ready to go. I want you to be ready to pick up your phones, all right? Anything under the sun you want to ask me about today, anything under the sun you want to question me about today, anything under the sun you want to follow up with that I've talked about, anything under the sun where you differ with me, have a different perspective, want to challenge my perspective, I'm going to open the phone lines wide today. I've been doing some extra interviews this week in the first hour. Got another one tomorrow in the first hour. So I want to open the phone lines more widely in the second hour. This is Michael Brown, your voice of moral sanity and spiritual clarity. I do hope and trust that you understand why we are addressing the themes we are addressing. I do hope you understand why we talk about moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution, meaning a gospel-based transformation of society, not anger, not intimidation, not hatred, not violence, God forbid. Rather, God's people living revolutionary lives, by which I mean we give ourselves to the gospel, we give ourselves to the cause, by which I mean we really take the Great Commission seriously, by which I mean we live for Jesus as if he really is the Savior and the Lord, by which I mean that we are so radically changed that we go and change our world, not by imposing the Bible on society and telling everyone you must submit to what the Bible says or you're going to jail, but rather to transform thinking, to transform laws, to transform culture by God's ways, by demonstrating that God's ways are best, by showing that the ways of the world don't work, that ultimately the sexual revolution burns out and dies. You have people, many people, who were terribly promiscuous earlier in life. They're ashamed of it today. They're committed to their spouse. They say, I did that, and it wasn't even fun, you know, or whatever fun I had, the punishment was greater than the reward, or the bad was greater than the good. There are plenty of us that were reckless in our lives. As many of you know, I was a heavy drug user for 2 years before coming to faith in Jesus. I'm not proud of that. I don't say, oh, that was a good eye-opening experience. No, that was wasteful, destructive, and almost killed me because of the foolishness with which I consume large amounts of drugs. But when you follow God, here Nancy and I going on 40 years of marriage, 40 years next March, God willing, do we wish that we had been unfaithful to each other? Oh, and if we could just have more flings, what? What? Do we wish, because Nancy used to get high and drank a lot before she was saved, we could go back to the old ways of getting high, getting drunk? What? Of course not. I've heard from so many people that have been through Teen Challenge, for example. They've been through Teen Challenge and they've gotten free from drug addictions, alcohol addictions. They're so happy to be free. They're so glad that they're free. They're so thrilled to be off the drugs and to be no longer bound by destructive habits. Do you find someone that used to be bound by a particular lust, a particular sin? This person was bound by pornography. This person was bound by alcohol. This person was bound by drugs. This person was bound by stealing. This person was bound by some other life-controlling fleshly sin. And now that they're free, that they hate being free, that they wish they could be bound again? No, what am I saying? God's ways are ways of life. And that's what we must stand for. And that's what we must live out. I got a bunch of things to talk to you about. I at the invitation of Christian Post, wrote 40 answers to 40 questions from Matthew Vines. Maybe I'll share some of that with you. Matthew Vines, young, quote, gay Christian activist. We'll take your calls, 866-34-TRUTH.
Flame, send the
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back, friends, to the Line of Fire broadcast. This is Michael Brown. My delight to come your way live 2 hours a day, 5 days a week. Some of you get the first hour of the broadcast, some the second hour or part of the first or part of the second. You can catch all the broadcasts later on our website, Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org. And when you go there, just click on Latest Broadcast. Always check for my latest articles. By the way, did you get my e-blast? No, I don't know about your e-blast. Ah, okay, listen. Just twice a week, sometimes three times, but twice a week, we'll email you. The end of the week, we'll send you an email with a summary of all the articles I've written in the week. Normally at least three, sometimes four, sometimes five. Maybe we've put up a new video too, five, six, 7 minute video of interest, an excerpt from the radio broadcast or some other special recording that we've made. So this way, you'll know at the end of the week where each article is. You can check on them. Also, earlier in the week, we'll let you know about the weekly special resource offer. We'll have a video clip that you can watch as well. And it's always something special. It's always something important, specially priced, maybe something you've wanted to get, and now we've packaged it in a special way for you. And if there's something special going on that I want you to know, or something on my heart, or important message, you might get a third email, but it's a great way to be in touch with us and to keep track of what's happening. If you say, well, I don't want to wait till the end of the week to know, well, then use Facebook or use Twitter. Either one, go to my website, askdrbrown.org. You'll see an icon to connect with us on Facebook or on Twitter. And then the moment an article is posted, the moment we have a new video posted, we will notify you immediately. Absolutely immediately. We will notify you, and you'll then be able to watch the video, read the article, share it with your friends. 866-34-TRUTH. We hear over and over and over from folks who thank us for being a voice. They're frustrated. You're frustrated. You're watching the news like, pulling your hair out. You're watching some TV show. You thought it was a family show, and now there's some aggressive, immoral scene. It's like, where did that come from? It's supposed to be a family network or a gay activist agenda just being pushed. I mean, come on, I'm not looking for that. We just want to sit down as a family and watch this thing. Why does everything have to be politicized? You're frustrated. Well, by God's grace, I can be a voice for you. I can be frustrated, but now I'll turn that to prayer and then turn that to a burden. And then by God's grace, I will be able to write something that'll probably articulate a lot of what you're feeling or say something on the radio. Some days I can't wait. It's like the night before, and I can't wait to get on the air the next day because there's so much on my heart I want to share with you, hence me being introduced on the air as your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. And then as you share the broadcast with others, tell them to tune in, or as you read the articles and share them with others on Facebook and Twitter, now I can articulate a lot of what you're feeling. Maybe you have a feeling, but you can't articulate it scripturally, or you don't have all the facts about what's happening, or you don't quite find the right words. Maybe I can do that for you, and then I can be your voice, and now you can interact with others more intelligently on it. So it's our goal to equip. It's our goal to get you thinking. And for those who differ, let's have a conversation. I can't do it on Facebook. Somebody posted this. Oh, I got to find this. Hang on. I got to find this. Did I save it? Did I save it? I'm not sure. Maybe not. Oh, yeah. Here it was. I asked you a question. I guess he posted something earlier. I found it later. And if I don't get an answer by tomorrow, I will be forced to believe you're a bigot. If that's the case, then I'm going to call you names and tell you things about yourself that you know to be true but are too much of a coward to believe, so you make fun of other people. So you have until 9 a.m. Good luck. I actually wrote back and said, well, we receive as many as 300,000 or more comments a week on our page, so we're not going to see a lot of them, and we can't get to everybody. And then I had a polite response, and then that was that for that one. But how about this? I'm writing to the AMA, American Medical Association, to ask them to disqualify you from practicing medicine and then suing you for malpractice. It's a guy named Eric. And I said, Eric, thanks for the kind words. Smile. Also, I'm a PhD doctor, not a medical doctor. Be well. And he wrote back, you'll no more outlast the gay revolution. The Confederate flag will outlast state buildings in the South. Well, Eric, we'll see, won't we? We shall see. This much I know. God's word is going to outlast the gay revolution. God's word is going to outlast every earthly revolution. God's word is going to outlast every earthly kingdom. Isaiah 40 makes plain that human beings, we're just like the grass. We're going to pass away, but God's word stands forever. Jesus makes plain, Matthew 24, heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will never pass away. Of that, we are 100% sure. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to the phones. Houston, Texas. Denise, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi, Dr. Brown. How are you?
Doing well, thanks.
Need some clarification from the subject you brought up yesterday regarding that if a child came to their parents and said they were homosexual, you said the response should be unconditional love.
Mm-hmm.
And most people, when they think of unconditional love, they think of no boundaries. There's not a I love you but or if. So I guess I need clarification because several weeks ago you did a question about if someone came to you about same-sex marriage, would you attend? So if you tell your child you have unconditional love for them, and their next question is, well, will you come to my same-sex marriage? What does that unconditional love look like? What is
Great.
The response
Yes.
of that unconditional love?
All right. Thank you so much for raising this question, Denise. I really appreciate it. Let me first say that because I've talked to so many Christian parents that don't know how to approach this, I talked to a couple of weeks ago, and the mother was crying, and she was talking about her teenage daughter came out as gay, and she's living with the aunt now, and I said, why? She said, well, I told her I didn't want her in my house. And I said, no, that's the wrong approach. All she's telling you is she has these feelings, and she's telling you how she feels. And I said, you reach out to her and you get her back in the house. So I often see a wrong reaction or parents getting mad as if the kid made a conscious choice. Hey, I'm choosing to have these homosexual desires. They're probably terrified to tell their parents if they're raised in a Christian home. They probably don't know what to expect. So when I say unconditional love, what I mean is, No matter what they say to you, no matter who they say they are, they're still your son, they're still your daughter, and that's what you want them to know. In other words, even if someone's behavior was such, let's say you had a kid who was dealing drugs, and they're in the home, and they're dealing drugs, and you say, listen, this house is not a drug dealing house, and if you're going to deal drugs, you can't live under this roof. Now, you can have unconditional love for them. In other words, you're still my son. I still love you. I'm going to pray for you every day. And when you're in need, you call me because you're my son. But you're not staying in this house. So when I say unconditional love, it could be misunderstood. So thank you for the question. So first, what I want to reaffirm is that kid needs to know, I love you just the same. Just because you told me you're attracted to the same sex, I'm not disowning you as my child. I'm not rejecting you as my child. I'm not instantly saying you're eternally damned for hell and that's the end of the story right here and now. And if you have a need, if you have a problem, I'm your mom, I'm your dad, I'm here for you just the same. Okay, so start there. I would also reinforce, you know what we believe. You know that we're convinced, according to Scripture, that homosexual practice is wrong, but we still love you as our child. You don't need to keep telling them that because they're aware of that. They know that you believe that. As for specific behaviors, let's say your daughter, 17, is very openly flaunting a sexually immoral relationship with her lesbian friend. You can say, hey, that's not going to happen under my roof. You're making a spectacle at the school. You're doing this, you're doing that. That's unacceptable. If you want to live here and we provide food and shelter for you, you're going to have to break up that relationship. You can do that. If they say, will you come to my wedding? You say, no, I couldn't. Of course, I don't believe it is a wedding, but I'm here for you either way. So yes, there are parameters in terms of what we participate in, what we don't. For example, if someone says, I'd like my boyfriend, a guy says, I'd like my boyfriend to come for Christmas dinner, we have to pray about it. Maybe it's a great way to reach out and share the gospel, But if you say, hey, if you want to spend the night here, you're spending the night in two separate rooms, there's going to be no homosexual relationship in our home, you have to figure out where to put those parameters up. So thank you for asking. I'm glad I was misunderstood in terms of the unconditional love as opposed to the parameters part, because I do want to emphasize that. But absolutely, absolutely, of course, there are family parameters and house parameters that must be put up. Absolutely. That's part of love in my book.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes. Again, thank you for calling and asking for clarification. Much appreciated. 866-34-TRUTH. We'll be back with your calls again. I'm happy to stay on moral, cultural-related topics. Maybe you don't know how to approach things. Maybe you feel like pulling your hair out. Maybe you differ with me. But I'm open to talk about just about anything today, just today, here on The Line of Fire.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
By the way, I mentioned a few days ago, Michael Brown here on The Line of Fire. Phone lines open, 866-34-TRUTH. I mentioned that last week I saw a question on Twitter. Again, I don't see many of the things posted there. But I saw a question on Twitter, and I thought the person was being sarcastic, facetious. I don't know much about the Bible, but I saw this website that says that the Bible doesn't really say what we think it says about homosexuality. Could you help me? So I answered as if the person was serious, and I said, yeah, that's one of the most error-filled websites I've seen here. Watch this video, listen to this lecture. It will clarify things for you. And then the person wrote back saying, thanks, I'll listen as soon as I can. I thought, oh, were they being serious? And then they sent another note saying, oh, that really helped. Thank you. You know, I really don't know the word that much, and that helps so much. So I thought, oh, praise God. I'm glad that I answered seriously rather than just thinking they were being sarcastic. Well, this fellow Hans, I assumed he was being serious. I've been trying to get your message out, but everyone who sees it, who has even the most limited grasp on reason and reality, insists you're a nut job. This is a common reaction. I would say there's a good chance. Now, I answered as if he was being totally sincere, but there's an excellent chance that he is completely being sarcastic and he thinks I'm a nut job, and this is his way of underscoring it. So if I get a reaction to my sincere comment to him, I will let you know. Before I go to the phones, just a quick note about demographics. I had Sean McDowell on the show yesterday. He's in his late 30s, son of Josh McDowell. We talked about interacting with the younger generation. And you might have the perception, okay, I'm 60, so you might have the perception that most of the people I reach are older. Most of the people I reach are my generation, and that we're kind of out of touch with the younger generation. But check this out. On our Facebook page with 130,000 fans, and then the interaction with others can reach into the millions. But right on the page itself, those who are, quote, fans, no, that's not the word we use. That's the word Facebook use, as opposed to your friends, which can only have 5,000. Then a public page, you can have fans, so you can have unlimited number. So some, you know, these celebrities, they have tens of millions of fans on Facebook. We've got 130,000, but they're very active. And all of you participating there, you are super active. And sometimes in a week, we can reach more than pages 10 times our size. But I posted this morning. Did you know that, one, the largest single demographic group of fans on this Facebook page are men aged 25 to 34? And secondly, that we have more men aged 18 to 24 than aged 55 to 64. And that 57% of our fans are between the ages of 18 and 44. And that the largest single block of fans are women aged 25 to 54. And then, after the USA, the next top countries represented on this page are the Philippines. Could it be because we have a large team of our missionaries there in the Philippines? Could that be? And they've influenced many to join us. Philippines, India, Singapore. It's got to be because of my recent trips to Singapore. India, perhaps the large number of people in India. Of course, I've been there many times. Then Canada, UK, Australia, South Africa, Hungary, and Nigeria. And then I noticed this comment from Zakaria Yusuf. I'm 16 years boy from India. Honestly, I like your page. I'm not in your range. No problem. Wisdom matters. And someone wrote back to him asking him about his background. And lo and behold, he comes from a Muslim family. He says he's converted Christian by faith, still didn't get a chance for water baptism living in Muslim family. Isn't that sweet? Those are some of the people we get to reach on Facebook, 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Christy in Clam Lake, Wisconsin. Christy, I believe this is the first call I've gotten from Clam Lake.
Well, I'm on vacation actually right now with some of our youth. My husband is a full-time youth pastor at our church, and they are out exploring the North Woods right now, and I'm cleaning up the cabin. So,
terrific.
I was listening to your program.
Excellent. Good. So your question.
My question really is, I just want to, just real brief, is I became a Christian when I was 14 years old, and one of my siblings entered into the homosexual lifestyle soon after I became a Christian. And so I have just, as a Christian, just always been up on this topic. And one of the things that I just have noticed in the recent culture of what's happening is it just seems like no one is talking about in 1 Corinthians where Paul says, you know, he lists those people who do not inherit the kingdom of God, but then he says, such were some of you. And I know so many who have walked away from the gay lifestyle, and I just was hoping that maybe you could talk about 1 Corinthians where it says that Paul pretty much probably had to have encountered those who used to be in the homosexual lifestyle but have walked away from it.
Oh, without question. And in fact, it's a verse that we constantly quote when we reach out to the homosexual community, that Paul is not talking about someone's inner feelings. He's talking about their behavior and their actions. The person who's an adulterer is known to be an adulterer because they are unfaithful to their spouse. The person who's a fornicator is known to be a fornicator because they're having sex outside of wedlock. The person who's a drunkard is known to be a drunkard because they are going out and getting drunk on a regular basis. The person that is a practicing homosexual is known as such because they are practicing homosexuality. And Paul says, such were some of you. That means that among the Corinthians, and remember, they were maybe around 75 people when he wrote 1 Corinthians to them, the house churches, and it was overall small. Among them were people who had come out of these various sins, which would have included people who formerly were practicing homosexuals. So whether they went from homosexual to heterosexual, in some cases would be the case, or whether they simply ceased practicing homosexuality and now were celibate. Yeah, I, like you, know many who have come out of homosexuality, some happily married in heterosexual marriages, others living celibate lives, but it's been many, many, many years now. I've run into so many, I've heard from so many when I speak around the country. Many times they'll come up to me after a message and thank me with a big smile and tell me their story. So yes, such were some of you. The idea that this can never change or that there's no freedom in Jesus is just a modern myth.
And that's really my point, is that it seems like this whole debate right now is, when we talk about, you know, the Matthew Vines versus you or Dr. Gagnon, that it's like we limit the power of God. And we're like saying, oh, this is too hard of a sin. God can't redeem this. He can't take care of this. And it's like, yes, he can. And I just want to keep pointing back to that. Yes, he can. There's the Cy Rogers and the Ann Polks of the world and the Mike Gokies of the world that have just walked away from that and have used that just to just shine for Christ. And that's just what I want, that message to be heard, that this is not just some special sin that only certain people can know how to minister to people with. It's just a sin.
Right. And look, every situation can be complex, and some people can specialize in ministering in certain ways, but we just need to put this in the category of become a disciple, and the church is here for you, and Jesus will give grace. Thank you for shouting it out. I'll share a quote with you on the other side of the break.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back to the Line of Fire broadcast. This is Michael Brown. I am thrilled to be with you. The phone lines are open, 866-34-TRUTH. I do want to discuss in a moment some moral issues, some issues in terms of obeying the law or not obeying the law. But I just want to go back to a point our last caller made, that we don't want to put homosexuality into a special category, that this is the one thing no one can ever change. The behavior is absolutely changeable. I want to start there. Every behavior is changeable by God's grace and power. Every behavior is changeable. You can be a kleptomaniac. You can be a heroin addict. You can be a nymphomaniac. You can be an alcoholic. You can have all kinds of addictive behaviors and be set free and change that behavior by the power of God. Bad eating habits, whatever. I found those harder to change than giving up drugs. But by God's grace, those have completely changed in my life. So all those can be changed. Now, what about the heart attitude? Yeah, God can change the heart attitude. What about the depth of the who that person is? Yes, God can change that too. But look, I am a heterosexual male. I still have to watch my eyes. If I walk past some rack of magazines and there's some scantily clad gal, I have to be conscious. You know, don't look at that. That's defiling. You know, let's say I'm sitting in an airport, and right across from me, there's some scantily dressed, attractive woman. I have to know, okay, don't look over there. That's inappropriate. Why? I'm a heterosexual male, and I can have lustful thoughts, so I have to be disciplined. But in my heart of hearts, I'm a servant of God and loyal and devoted to my wife. So someone may struggle with same-sex attraction, but in their heart of hearts, they are wholly given over to the Lord, serving God in a serious way. So in my responses at the request of Christian Post, I wrote out 40 answers to Matthew Vine's 40 questions. Matthew Vine's a young gay activist who is a professing Christian. And I wrote out 40 answers and then gave two simple questions to Matthew at the end. But let's just see where this is, the specific one. I'm trying to find it here. I'm asking specifically, are you telling me that God cannot change a homosexual into a heterosexual? Now, the calling is to be holy. So if someone is same-sex attracted, the call to holiness means to say no to those desires, to recognize that those things are sinful, and to say, okay, I renounce them, and I am not going to act on them, all right? So that's one thing. To say that they become heterosexual, that's another thing. But God has done that for people. God has done that. And I ask forthrightly, are you telling me that God can't change a homosexual into a heterosexual if he wants to? Come on, where would we get such an idea aside from the propaganda of the day? 866-34-TRUTH. If you haven't read the article yet, by all means, go to AskDrBrown.org and please do read that. I want to get to some more calls. Anything you want to discuss with me, phone lines are open on the other side of the break, 866-34-TRUTH. I've got a report here from the Beckett Fund from today. Three religious institutions appeal to Supreme Court, say they will fight to protect their faith. Absolutely. Former Hobby Lobby attorneys appeal HHS mandate on behalf of prominent religious schools forced to violate faith or pay millions in IRS fines. So now this is coming from a different angle, not related to the most recent Supreme Court decision. But there are going to be a lot of challenges for the court in the coming days. What happens? This is it. This is the law. Can't be overturned. Can't be stopped. What do we do? How do we respond? To me, it's really simple. We'll talk about it when we come back. Take your calls as well. Stay right here.
Flame, send the fire.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Yeah, look at this report from the Beckett Fund. Today, two private universities and a seminary are asking the Supreme Court to protect them from millions of dollars in IRS fines that will be triggered if they refuse to comply with the infamous HHS mandate. Filing the petition today are the same two firms that won the Hobby Lobby case against the government's HHS mandate 1 year ago. So Diana Verm, legal counsel at Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty, said the government has already told thousands of businesses they don't need to comply with the HHS mandate. So why is it bullying nuns, religious schools, soup kitchens, and homeless shelters until they comply? It makes no sense. Dr. Robert Sloan, president of Houston Baptist University, said this: "We didn't go looking for this fight, but here we stand and we can do no other. We cannot help the government or anyone else provide potentially life-threatening drugs and devices. The government has many other ways to achieve its goals without involving us. It ought to pick one of those and let us go back to educating our students." Hey, there are a whole bunch of issues now that we didn't go asking for, that we didn't pick this fight. We are simply responding. Let's go to the phones. 866. All right. I was going there. 866-34-TRUTH is the number to call. Dennis, grab clip number 10. This is the Young Turks from yesterday. Beware of people preaching about morality. And there are people who are upset with Attorney General Ken Paxton in the state of Texas because he is saying that the Supreme Court's ruling on redefining marriage is unconstitutional and wrong, and that he will direct people to disobey. Here's an article on The Daily from Monday. Maybe Texas Attorney General Ken, don't give a darn. Paxton should have kept his mouth shut. After the Supreme Court shocked unreasonable people across the United States, obviously this is not a conservative-friendly site. After the Supreme Court shocked unreasonable people across the United States by ruling that states cannot discriminate against same-sex couples who want to get married, Texas's beloved Paxton gave the green light to discriminate. Paxton, who remembers under investigation for allegedly violating state securities laws, used his office after the ruling to tell county clerks that they don't have to play ball with the federal government if it violates their religious beliefs. This is so off the beaten path for these. This is so unbelievable. It's so incredible that anybody could have a religious reason to say, hey, we're not going to comply with what the Supreme Court says. As if there's no rational reason, whatsoever for people saying, hey, I can't comply with this. I can't comply with the redefinition of marriage. I can't be party to it. They seem to have no ability to conceive that there could be any possible objection to changing the most fundamental aspect of human relations in the world through history and just shifting it. So now words just have no meaning. I now pronounce you wife and wife. I now pronounce you husband and husband. The baby's parents are two women. One is the mother, one is the father on the birth certificate. You're getting married in England, and two men, one is the husband, one is the wife, and words just have no meaning. You just throw it all out, and there's no big deal. And you redefine the nature of family and upbringing of children and on. Wow, wow, wow. It's mind-boggling to me that people cannot understand why anyone would have the slightest problem with it. But the reactions are intense. So clip number 10, listen to what one of the Young Turks has to say.
The Attorney General for Texas is a guy named Ken Paxton. And if there's one thing we know about him, he cares about morality. This gay marriage, it cannot stand. When the Supreme Court said, hey, everybody's got to respect the rule of law here and you all have to allow for gay marriage in all of your states, Ken Paxton wasn't buying him. He said county clerks and their employees retain religious freedoms that may allow accommodation of their religious objections to issuing same-sex marriage licenses. The strength of any such claim depends on the particular facts of each case. Meaning that county clerks in Texas might be able to unilaterally, according to the dictates of their attorney general, turn around and say, no, I'm not going to listen to the Supreme Court. I don't care about the rule of law. My morality trumps your law. So I get to make moral decisions on my own. And so if I don't like gay people and I don't want them getting married, I'm just not going to give them a license. I mean, that is outrageous. He should be fired for that immediately, to say that they're not going to follow the law of the land.
Ah, very interesting. Now, I don't know the historic stand of the Young Turks as far as their view of the law of the land and the sanctity of the law of the land. But what this attorney general is saying is, look, we have a constitution for a reason. And the judges are not there to create new realities. The judges are there to make sure that we live by our laws and our principles and our constitution and our bylaws and our amendments and things like that. So when there is absolutely no constitutional basis for this change, read the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment does not in any way give the slightest hint of redefining marriage. And if you talk to the founding fathers about the idea that, yeah, that later courts will find in your documents justification for two men or two women to, quote, marry, they would say that you have lost your mind. But let me take this a little further. What about the Dred Scott ruling in the 1800s? Was it right for Abraham Lincoln and his administration to countermand that or to ignore its reality and to say we are going to treat blacks in America as full human beings? What about the rule of law? Well, the law was wrong. The courts were wrong. And I wonder, when Mayor Gavin Newsom, when he was mayor of San Francisco, and when Gavin Newsom said specifically that when he began to hand out marriage licenses to gay couples, it was illegal. He began to do it anyway. He was hailed as a pioneer, as a hero, as an innovator, as a bold, courageous man. I wonder if the Young Turks would have said of him, lawbreaker, what about the sanctity of the rule of law? Is there any situation ever where your moral values, biblically based, sound moral values, would cause you to say, I respect the law, but in this case, I cannot submit to it. I cannot obey it. Are there times when conscience demands that you do? Let's remember, friends, that our religious freedoms are at the very foundation, the bedrock foundation of our society. Not just philosophically saying it's important to do, but recognizing that the system won't operate properly without those religious freedoms in place. That the system, the American democratic system, will not operate properly unless there is a moral, faith-based people making up a strong percentage of the nation. This was an assumption of the founding fathers. It's found philosophically, overtly, covertly in many of the documents, and it's kind of shocking to see how strong that thread was. I may write an article about this in coming days. Don't mess with America's spiritual ecology, meaning that there's a system set up. And the way America is set up, it's set up to operate with certain givens. And one of those givens is that there is religious freedom and there is robust faith in God, the Creator, although there is not one state church that is sanctioned in the land. That's something that they got away from, leaving the Church of England and coming here to these shores. A few years back, Nancy and I were on a cruise, the one and only cruise we've been on in our lives. It was a cruise to Alaska. It was with a Messianic Jewish group, and we were encouraged to bring other people to get them to come on the cruise with us. And then I was invited to speak, so we didn't have to pay. I got a free cruise for Nancy and me just by being a speaker at this event, and that would help draw people in. Well, problem was I didn't get anybody to go. I guess when for years we've been saying take up the cross, take up the cross, take up the cross, take up the cross, to say go on a cruise, it just didn't resonate with our folks, although it was a great experience for people who did go. But anyway, I did speak. I did pour myself out in that respect. We did try to be a blessing however we could financially on the cruise to the group that invited us. But Nancy and I got to go out and do some amazing touring, this boat trip, this nature trip out, pretty good way out to the sea. And there were these, what were they called? Were they walruses or some, you know, one of these big creatures like that. And they were telling us how they allowed more hunting of these some years back, but they cut back on it because it messed up the whole ecological system. That these big creatures ate these other fish, and these fish ate these other fish, and these other fish ate these plants, and these other plants did this, and it started to, the ecological system started to break down. Why? Because they messed with it. You don't mess with America's spiritual ecology. If you do, it's going to bring disaster.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right, I checked this out. My friend Marcus sent this to me yesterday. I had not seen this. It was on the reasonablefaith.org website, so William Lane Craig. In his dissent, the Supreme Court decision, Justice Scalia observed that, quote, not a single evangelical Christian, a group that comprises about one quarter of Americans, or even a Protestant of any denomination sits on the court. Dr. Craig says that fact is a stinging indictment of the evangelical church. We have not set before our youth the vision of serving God by pursuing a career as a judge. We are reaping the whirlwind of our own passivity and lack of engagement. Now is not the time to withdraw to the sanctuary of our churches and institutions, which, in the opinion of the dissenting justices, will come increasingly under threat as a result of this very decision, but to involve ourselves in those public institutions that so shape the culture in which we live. Wow. Quite a stinging indictment. Quite a stinging quote. 866-34-TRUTH. We go to Dallas, Texas. You, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi, Dr. Brown.
Hey.
I just have a concern about whether we as Christians, I mean, let me say right off, I totally disagree with the Supreme Court decision, and I'm sad of the decision that they made, but I'm concerned that as Christians we're pressing, we're getting involved in legislation, we're trying to get involved in law, in the secular world, which I don't think we're supposed to be doing.
Why not?
Well, because I don't see one example in the New Testament where Christ or any of the apostles in their writings indicate that we're supposed to go to Caesar and try to prevent people from doing what God calls sin. We're supposed to preach it, and if we suffer for preaching it, then so be it, and it's expected that we do that, but not to try to mandate and force people.
But who's not, who's trying to mandate or force anyone? The first thing is that Jesus got involved in legal discussion with the people of his day, with Jewish leaders, because that was the sphere of influence they had. There was nothing in Caesar that you could do. There was no ability to interact. There was no democracy. We see the prophets constantly advocating for justice and calling for it, and we see that call for justice reiterated in the New Testament. Those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, those who seek God's kingdom and his righteousness. So if there is injustice in the society, we're called to feed the poor, we're called to care for the needy, we're called to be salt, we're called to be light. However we can be involved, we want to be involved. After all, we've been here for 2,000 years now. So it's not like we're just skipping through town. We've been here for 2,000 years. So we're not worldly in our mentality, but why should we even feed the poor? I mean, that's of this world. Why should we visit the orphans? That's of this world. Why should we stand for justice and righteousness? That's of this world. Why even be involved in this world at all?
I think, if you don't mind me saying, Dr. Brown, I think that that's actually just taking it to an extreme, because I mean, they're two separate issues. One is legislation, One is enforcement, and one is, first of all, a direct call from Jesus Christ, from God, to very specifically feed the poor and help, you know, the unfortunate and the needy.
All right. So what if there were laws? What if there were laws in the society that were causing tremendous suffering for the poor? Then we don't address those laws? We don't address injustice? What if because of the law, because of unjust law, that there was now a massive increase in poverty and children were starving to death because of unjust laws, that we therefore don't touch it because it's a law?
No, we feed the poor. We help them.
But we don't address the law. If addressing the law is the whole cause of it, and there's never going to be enough to feed the poor, but if we could fix the law, we could alleviate that. On what basis are you saying we don't address a law? I mean, I don't see any hint of Scripture telling me not to address a law.
Christ's kingdom is not of this world. If it were, the apostles would have fought to keep him from being crucified.
If his kingdom is not of this world, that has. So then we shouldn't feed the poor. So then we shouldn't work jobs. That is a complete It's a complete misapplication of his words. What he's talking about is he is not now setting up an earthly kingdom that his disciples will fight for. Look, you're calling me on a phone. That's being of this world. You're listening to a radio broadcast. That's part of being in this world. Do you work a job? Did you get paid for working a job? When you got married, did you get a legal certificate that you were married? Do your kids have Social Security numbers? Do you have a driver's license? That's all being in this world. If you want to go live on a mountain somewhere and say we're not of this world and pray all day, that's one thing. But we're in this world. We are not trying to force people to live God's way. What we're doing is we're advocating for what's right and we're being people of conscience. If Christians thought the way you thought, we'd still have slavery. We'd still have other abominable things happening. There'd be no one trying to stop the slaughter of the unborn. And we'd just be preaching the gospel and not living holistically as disciples. I fundamentally differ with you, but thank you, sir, for calling. Let's go to Tom in High Point, North Carolina. Hey, Tom, we're almost out of time, but let's go for it real quick.
Well, a pragmatic thing for... The homosexual thing is get a whole bunch of men, put them on an island, and see what you find in 100 years.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, the fact is homosexuality within itself cannot reproduce. I remember talking to a gay guy on a flight one day, and I said to him, if you could snap your fingers and be straight, would you? And it was yes and no. On the one hand, you know, he likes his life and he likes the friends and it's part of who he is. On the other hand, he said to me with sadness, we can't have children. So there has to be an artificial way to do it, and you have to involve someone other than your partner, which is a sad fact. So yes, sadly, if you put 10 gay couples on an island and they were exclusively homosexual, and you came back 100 years from then, there'd be no one on that island. If you put 10 heterosexual couples on that island, you come back 100 years later, and you'd have a growing population. So one thing does reproduce. Another doesn't. Look, I don't say that gloatingly. I don't say, ha, ha, ha. No, I just say it to say that it's why God made things the way he did. They function a certain way. When we deviate from that, let's recognize it's a deviation and work constructively to address it. All right, friends, we are out of time. If you're blessed by this broadcast, if you're strengthened, encouraged, edified, if we're helping to equip you, if this broadcast is making a difference in your life, join our support team. Become a torchbearer today. You can put aside $1 a day or more per month, so $30 or more per month. Join our support team. You'll be on the front lines with us 24/7. You'll hold my hands up as I go around the world, and we'll sow back into you a free message, a new message every month, 15% discount in our online bookstore, and access to our online classes that us have to pay for. Go to our website, AskDrBrown.org, click donate to stand with us. My bottom line today, let us submit ourselves to the ways of God. They alone bring life.